Blog Talk Radio. To the Yaron Brook Show. As you may have guessed, this is not Yaron Brook speaking. This is Amanda Maxim. I'm a writer and a research associate here at the Ayn Rand Institute, and I'm excited to be here in the studio. Actually, we've taken over the studio with Don Watkins, my colleague.
Hi, I'm a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute.
And today we're going to be talking, we have a guest, Amish Adalja. He's an infectious disease expert and a critical care physician, and we're going to be interviewing him and talking to him about vaccines.
So I think it's a really interesting topic. Certainly there's kind of more specific scientific issues to do with vaccines, but there's a lot of questions about and claims made concerning their safety, concerning their efficacy, and I think it's important to be able to parse through those claims as individuals to decide whether or not we're going to get vaccinated or get our children vaccinated. And then there's a lot of policy questions concerning what is the role of government in mandating vaccinations, in protecting a parent's right to not vaccinate their child if they have that right. And so I think we're going to dig into these claims and try to get at least a broad view how to think about these issues.
Okay, so Amish Adalja, are you on the line?
Yeah, I'm here. Thanks.
Hi, welcome to the show. So first, maybe you can talk a little bit about who you are and what do you do?
So I'm an infectious disease physician. I work at the University of Pittsburgh, but I'm not speaking on their behalf. I'm kind of here as myself as an individual. And I work on pandemic policy, emerging infectious diseases, the risks of bioterrorism, kind of anything big or bad or catastrophic in the world of infectious disease or healthcare. I focus on those types of topics.
All right. Well, we're excited to sit down and talk to you today about vaccines. But in some ways, maybe it's a strange topic because we know that vaccines have saved, millions or billions of lives? What's the number like?
It depends on the estimates you look at, but it's literally hundreds of millions of lives have been saved by vaccines. That's why childhood today is like an idyllic time and not a time where you're worried about a child getting a fever and then dying, and why people don't have 10 children anymore, because we know that most children are going to survive into adulthood.
So if it's on the order of hundreds of millions of lives saved through vaccines, why are they controversial?
They've actually been controversial from the very beginning. So the first vaccine was the one against smallpox that was developed by Edward Jenner. And as soon as he developed that vaccine, there were already cartoons in the 1700s in England depicting horrible side effects that were going to happen to people who received the smallpox vaccine. So the anti-vaccine movement has been around for a long time, and it may be due to the fact that there's been a taboo about altering your body or altering anything that you do that's going to alter the way you were born, and it's not necessarily the plan for humans. This is probably where it started from. And now it's morphed into, this is unsafe, these are chemicals, it's just kind of the modernization of what really was a very primitive idea that you shouldn't alter your own being. And you almost see the same type of philosophy animating the anti-GMO movement as well.
Yeah, definitely. So let's take a step back then. So why do vaccines work, or how do they work?
So vaccines, there's a myriad of different types of vaccines, but the vaccine 101 part of the very basic way a vaccine works is it takes whatever you're trying to protect against, whether it's the measles virus, the chickenpox virus, smallpox, influenza, and you weaken it, and then you administer it to that person. And what ends up happening is that vaccine then induces a person's immune response to the vaccine. And because the vaccine is similar to the real thing, when you then encounter the real thing later on in life, your body jumps into action, and the immune system stops the infection from happening. That's what a vaccine does in basics.
So when did Jenner invent the first vaccine?
In the late 1700s, and it's a very important story because this was the whole cowpox story where milkmaids were not getting smallpox because they were getting infected with cowpox and they were becoming protected against smallpox. So he really investigated that, and what he did is he took the cowpox virus and used that as a vaccine to protect people against smallpox, and that's where the word vaccine actually comes from the Latin word for cow, because of that. And then when Louis Pasteur invented the second vaccine against rabies, he used the term vaccine as an homage to Jenner.
So, I mean, obviously we've come a really long way in terms of what diseases we can vaccinate against since the 1700s. And maybe in the 1700s you could understand people's, you know, fear and trepidation of this new thing. But today, so what is it still, like, scientifically controversial? What does the science say? Is it clear that vaccines are a good thing?
Yes, it's clear. It's just as clear as, you know, as drinking water, as that you need water to live. Vaccines have saved countless lives, and this is evidence that's available to everybody. It's not some esoteric scientific explanation or proof. You know that you can go and ask your grandparents where they didn't have vaccines, or even ask, you know, I'm 40 years old, and I know how many vaccines I got as a child, and I know how many people get now, and I know what, you know, the fear of certain diseases, even in the 1970s and 1980s, is now gone in the United States because these cases are completely gone. People are, little children aren't dying of meningitis the way they did in even in the 70s or 80s, let alone what happened, you know, in the era of polio in the 1940s and 50s, where you know, people feared the summer because they were so scared of polio. And you don't see polio victims walking around, you know, you don't see young polio victims walking around the way it was commonplace in the 1940s. It's become, you know, it's a really a wholesale revolution in the way people can be free of the fear of diseases because of what vaccines have done. And you don't see this type of anti-vaccine movement for the most part in places like Africa, where there are still 150,000 people dying of measles every year. There they line up all night to get a vaccine. It's only here that we have this problem where people, you know, don't get vaccines and they all congregate together and basically make up a powder keg for measles to spread. And that's basically what we saw with the Disneyland outbreak.
Have there been any cases, or are there any side effects of most vaccines? And have there been any cases of vaccines that we thought were good but ultimately turned out to do more harm than good?
Yeah, so everything that you give to yourself has side effects. Every medication has side effects. Every vaccine can have a side effect. But the thing to remember with vaccines is that there's a risk-benefit analysis. And for the vast majority of vaccines, the benefit outweighs the risk by orders of magnitude. And there are vaccines that have been recalled. There are vaccines that have had side effects and problems. Some of them have had to do with contamination in the manufacturing. Some have been due to safety signals that emerged only after we gave the vaccine to a large amount of people. And the other point I would want to make is that the risk benefit is also going to depend upon the severity of the disease you're vaccinating. So, for example, smallpox was a disease that's now been eradicated off of the planet. And I actually work with the man who designed the program to eradicate it. And that vaccine does have serious side effects. And, you know, you expect, like, out of a million vaccinees, one will die. So when you have a disease that's gone from the planet, then the risk-benefit switches the other way. So the benefit for smallpox vaccination for the ordinary individual is not there because the risk of one in a million is too high to tolerate. So we've stopped vaccinating against smallpox because the risk is zero, and the risk of getting smallpox is zero, but the risk of the vaccine is higher than that. So we do make these calculations all the time, looking at the epidemiology and the prevalence of the disease. But of course, there have been, you know, there are cases of people having you know, very rare and tragic side effects from vaccines, but that's not the majority case of vaccines. And often you can there are certain risk factors that people have identified for severe reactions to vaccines, like people who are immunosuppressed, have certain genetic disorders, and you have to go through that with your doctor for every vaccine. And there always are, you know, we have medical exemptions in every state. So if someone has one of these reasons why they cannot be vaccinated because there's a high risk of a side effect, those people are exempted because it would become too dangerous for that person. But that's, like I said, a very small proportion of the population.
So, I mean, I noticed that in your evaluation of, you know, weighing risk and benefits, you didn't bring up some of the specific claims that I often hear about vaccines, namely that they could cause autism, they contain maybe dangerous heavy metals. Can you speak to some of those claims?
Yeah, so the autism claim is a very interesting one, and one that kind of spread like wildfire, unfortunately. And what it came from was a study in England by a man named Andrew Wakefield, who is kind of a hero to the anti-vaccine movement. But what you saw there was a small number of patients, 12 patients, where he advanced the hypothesis that maybe the measles, mumps, rubella, or the MMR vaccine was causing their intestines to become leaky, and that the bacteria from their intestines were getting into their bloodstream, and that was triggering autism. And it was a hypothesis that he put out there, and it basically was really seized upon by the autism community and the anti-vaccine movement, and then it basically became almost like a gospel and caused a lot of people to lose confidence in the vaccine. But the story has a lot more to it that most people don't know, that the paper was retracted. But the paper was retracted from the journal, The Lancet, which is a very prestigious British medical journal. Before it was retracted, many of the co-authors actually had removed their name because there was questions about the integrity of the data used to make those claims. And actually, the person lost his medical license, the lead author, Andrew Wakefield, because of concerns over fraud in that paper. But it didn't matter because certain celebrities had really picked up on that and have a huge microphone, which they used to amplify that message. And we had to do countless studies after the fact, which is tragic. You know, how many minds had to be wasted trying to basically disprove a negative, that there was actually not a plausible biological link that the MMR vaccine could cause autism. But yet we had to do massive studies showing the rates of autism and the rates of MMR and trying to disprove a negative, which eventually has been done. And even the vaccine court in the United States doesn't even include, its autism is not included as a compensatable condition if you supposedly have a vaccine reaction and get autism. But it's still something that's a very hard battle because people are afraid because they saw Jenny McCarthy, for example, one celebrity who's really been associated with this link, where she says things like, I don't need a clinical trial. My clinical trial is my son, and my son got the MMR, and now he has autism. And she makes this correlation causation type of confusion, and that takes hold in a lot of people's minds. And we've spent countless millions of dollars trying to disprove this negative.
I hear a lot something similar, which is with a flu shot, you'll often hear, every time I get a shot, I get the flu. And there's a wider phenomenon of people trying to draw kind of conclusions about medical causality through these kinds of experiences. And I wonder if you have thoughts on how to kind of prevent, how to check oneself from doing that, and how should a layman think about these sorts of issues?
It's very hard sometimes for me as a doctor to try and debunk a lot of these things because you're kind of trained to think that way as a physician it's drummed into you that correlation doesn't equal causation because an anecdote does not equal, you know, the truth. If one person has an experience, that doesn't necessarily mean that this is causing. You have to remember that, you know, for example, let's just take the flu shot causing the flu. So when do you get the flu shot? You get the flu shot in the middle of respiratory virus season. And it's not just one respiratory virus that's out there. There are countless different respiratory viruses. So you get the flu shot and you get sick. Did you truly get influenza? Or did you get a cold virus or a different virus that causes symptoms? The other thing is that the flu vaccine takes about 2 weeks to actually work. So if you get the flu, even if you get a real case of flu within 2 weeks of getting the vaccine, it was because you were exposed to flu and the vaccine didn't have time to work. Our flu virus, there's simple explanations that really, if you search and if you look on the internet and you look at reputable sites, you will find this type of information. But there's so much noise out there that it's very hard for the general person to do that. So I think what you have to do is kind of look at the vaccine manufacturer's literature, which some people may not trust because there's this anti-big pharma thing. But that's where you're going to actually get important information about what these vaccines do, what kind of side effects to expect, when to expect them to be protective, and debunk types of things like this. But it is sometimes hard because, in general, we have a population that doesn't really think about scientific matters in a manner that's logical or often rational, and that's a larger issue. And I know you guys at ARI work on a lot of these these issues on trying to get people to be able to think appropriately, because this is just a symptom of that. The fact that people can't understand why they don't get why the flu shot doesn't give them flu. That's a larger thinking problem that you're actually going at, because the information has been there since the 1940s.
So we talked about does the flu shot cause flu, and how people are thinking about using maybe anecdotal evidence or thinking that a correlation might imply a causation and using that inappropriately. And we talked also about this Andrew Wakefield study about vaccines causing autism. So I guess my question is, what is the autism thing? Is that the biggest misconception that general people or the media has about vaccines, or are there other big misconceptions that come up a lot for you?
The autism one is one of is probably the biggest one, because it had such legs with celebrities like Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey and, RFK Jr., a whole bunch of groups of people that were really vocal on this. And the media has actually been much better than on this issue, because they've actually rebutted most of these celebrities. And even some of the comedians like Jimmy Kimmel, for example, has really been a staunch advocate of vaccines and done a really good job debunking these things. But the other things that come up sometimes are, is a vaccine safe or not safe in pregnancy? And, for example, a lot of pregnant women won't get vaccines that are really beneficial. For example, the influenza vaccine, because that's the best way to protect your child from influenza while the child is gestating in utero, is to give the flu vaccine. And pregnant women are at high risk for very severe complications from influenza. We saw that really badly during the 2009 H1N1 influenza pandemic, where pregnant women were dying in disproportionate numbers because they were so at risk, and they weren't getting vaccinated because they were afraid of, harming the fetus, but they were doing the opposite by not getting vaccinated. The same thing happens with any type of so people are just really worried about what this vaccine will do to them, and pregnancy is probably one of the best examples. There are, concerns about so people are also very concerned about, there's metals in vaccines, and they really start worrying about, does the mercury in a vaccine cause mental problems? But there's another mistake there again, because the mercury that you worry about causing mercury poisoning in the brain is methyl mercury, and that's not the type of mercury that was in certain vaccines. That was ethyl mercury, and one of them has a very short half-life, one of them has a very long half-life. One of them accumulates, one does not, and people just basically obliterated that distinction, including RFK Jr. was the one that really did this and wrote a big article about it in Rolling Stone. And you had thimerosal, which was the mercury component that was in vaccines that was used as a preservative so that you could actually have multi-dose vials, and it was much better for storage, it was much cheaper. That had to be just basically removed voluntarily because of the backlash against mercury. And I used to tell people in interviews, I would say, I wish there was more mercury in vaccines, because that means our vaccines are going to last longer. And the same thing with aluminum. Aluminum is used to stimulate your immune system. It's an adjuvant, and it makes your vaccine work better. And there is a huge backlash against that because people don't want aluminum in their body. But that's what makes our vaccines better. And our flu vaccine would be better if it had aluminum in it, because some of the other countries have flu vaccines that are better than ours, and it's because they have aluminum in it. So it's almost not every time you hear something that the anti-vaccine movement say, it's actually the opposite that is true.
So we're here with Amish Adalja talking about vaccines. I'm Amanda Max. I'm here with Don Watkins, and we're going to take a short commercial break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
All right, and we're back in the Yaron Brook Show with Amish Adalja talking about vaccines. And I want to turn now to some of the policy issues. So in California, for example, I know you mentioned the recent measles outbreak in Disneyland. I think people were growing more and more concerned about these pockets of people who are not vaccinating their children. And so there was this push to pass Senate Bill 277 in June. And basically what this bill did was to eliminate the personal or religious exemption from getting your children vaccinated in order to go to public school. And I'm interested in your take on that, because I think a lot of people are concerned. They're wary when the government is telling them, essentially they view it as how to parent, or that the government is telling them what they should be, putting into their children's bodies. And so I think it becomes a personal issue. So I'm curious as to what your take is on mandatory vaccines.
So it's a complex issue, and I think it's really complex because of the fact that the government actually runs schools. And this isn't something you would see, in a laissez-faire capitalist society, but we don't live in a laissez-faire capitalist society, and the government does take a role in educating schools and own schools. And the point that I like to make is the fact that any school should be able to set the conditions of its enrollment, that if they want their students to be vaccinated, they should be able to make that as a stipulation, as a condition of entry. For example, the LaPorte schools, which is a private school, they have vaccine entry requirements that they require, and that's a private school that's not necessarily covered by these laws and operates in more than in other states other than California. And that's where the issue is. And does a school have a right to set enrollment? And the fact that if the government's running these schools, do you want them to run them you know, the best that they can run them, even though in the context of the fact that, you know, that you really want to encourage private education. But the fact is they run all of these schools and you want them to be run in an appropriate manner. And school should be a safe place where people can learn reading, writing, and arithmetic, not get measles, mumps, and rubella. It's not a place where it should be a safe place. And if you have a large population of unvaccinated children there, that school becomes a vector for spread of disease. And we've known this from antiquity, that's when people congregate together in a school, they can spread disease and other people are then put at risk. Suppose you have people that are too young to be vaccinated at a school for a certain vaccine. Now they're going to be exposed to somebody. What if someone's vaccine didn't take and they're still susceptible? Now they spread it to somebody else. What about the children who have immunosuppressing conditions that the school wants to enroll? They can't come to that school if there's going to be a large proportion of unvaccinated children. So it's really a safety issue. And the fact is, schools have the right to set their terms of enrollment. And remember, this isn't like vaccination. When they say mandatory, this is mandatory upon entering school. It's not mandatory as a condition of life. You know, it's not. So that distinction needs to be drawn as well.
I guess so. Thinking a little bit more broadly, I mean, you're bringing up some issues where, you know, if you have a parent, let's say, that's refused to vaccinate their child, and then their child gets sick, they put other children at risk. And it brings up these issues of, you know, individual rights. If someone is putting me at risk, then that's, you know, bringing up that issue. So what is the government's role when it comes to infectious diseases?
So for certain contagious diseases that have a high impact, that cause substantial morbidity and mortality, people, you know, it's not innocuous like getting the cold. I think of it as a violation of individual rights if you are knowingly exposed to that. And the government has the ability to quarantine and isolate people. And they've even forced vaccinated people during outbreaks because of, you know, for example, there was an outbreak of measles in Philadelphia in the 1990s, and there was a court order because a religious sect wasn't vaccinating children who were being put, you know, endangered basically because measles is not a benign disease. And the court ordered in Philadelphia that those children could be vaccinated against their parents' wishes. So I do believe the government has a role with certain contagious, high-impact infectious diseases to protect its citizens from those types from becoming infected. And their, you know, quarantine powers and have been basically around since the beginning of the country and have been used. Most people know of the case of Typhoid Mary. And the important part of that is that they have to be, you know, they're not used, you know, haphazardly. There are certain criteria that they're, when they're going to be enforced, and it's not an all or nothing. There's, you know, there are steps, and obviously you want people to do things voluntarily if you can, and it's only when they continually put other people at risk that you have to take action. And unfortunately for children, you can't say just, you know, stay out of town and stay in your house because they have to go to school and do other things. An adult is a different story because you can tell that adult if you're not vaccinated against whatever disease is spreading, you need to just stay in your house because you could actually spread that to somebody else. You could get infected and spread it to somebody else. So we want to kind of restrict your movements. But in a child, it's a much different story. And, you know, I often, you know, people were also often saying, you know, that these parents who aren't vaccinating their children were being selfish. I don't actually think they were being selfish. I think they were actually being self-destructive. Because if you don't vaccinate your child against measles, and they're somebody that, you know, that would be safe and fine to get the measles vaccine, you're endangering your child. It's not like we're asking parents to vaccinate their children against something like yellow fever, for which there's no real risk in the United States. We're asking them about a real clear and present danger that kills 150,000 children every year. So I think there comes a point where not vaccinating against certain diseases is actually neglectful. And it's not for every vaccine, but clearly some vaccines, I do believe it rises to the level of neglect.
Okay, so you mentioned the case of Typhoid Mary, and I'd be interested to hear, about that.
Well, yeah, typhoid is in the news again today because there's an outbreak of typhoid fever at the Qdoba in Colorado right now. But Typhoid Mary is a very famous story in the public health and infectious disease world. And she was an Irish immigrant who worked as a cook in the New York City area. And what happened was people who she would cook for would end up getting typhoid fever, and some of them would die. And eventually they figured, you know, there's a very big investigation to try and figure out where these typhoid cases were coming from. And eventually it was traced back to places that this woman, her name was Mary Mallon, cooked. And they discovered she was a typhoid carrier. She didn't have outward signs of typhoid, but yet she harbored it, I think, in her gallbladder, and she would shed that into her, and when she was cooking, she'd be shedding the bacteria and yet into the food. And the gist of the story is that they basically told her, you cannot cook anymore. You have to just do something. That was the government's position. You can't cook because you're putting people at risk when you cook, because you're putting these germs into the food, and the people are getting sick and they're dying. And you remember, this is in the pre-antibiotic era, so typhoid fever was a different illness then than it was today. And she basically told them, okay, I won't cook, but then changed her name, was found cooking in other places. And this continued for quite a while, of her basically trying to outrun the authorities, to the point where they said, we've told you multiple times to not cook. You continue to cook. You change your name. You evade surveillance. We asked you if you could get your gallbladder out, because that's where the bacteria is. If you get the gallbladder out, you can go back to your daily life. And she refused all of those, the ratcheting up of the public health powers, of the quarantine powers. And then they eventually had to quarantine her on an island in the East River called North Brother Island, where she lived out her life, because she continued to put people at risk. And that's a good example of how you use quarantine and isolation powers appropriately, where it was a ratcheting up with a clear demonstrable risk to other people, and in multiple times of, you know, basically criminal defiance criminal defiance of these public health orders that had been promulgated for good reason.
That's definitely an interesting case. So when you're talking about the risk that, you know, people can put other people in when they're not vaccinated, when they can be a harbor for a disease, in California, where we are, there's this concerning trend of more and more parents, you know, deciding not to vaccinate their children. And I read somewhere that the number of kindergartners in public schools whose parents have opted out from vaccinating can be upwards of, you know, 6% or more. So why, can you speak to why is that a problem, and what exactly is the risk?
So the risk is for certain. So we have a concept called herd protection or herd immunity. And what that concept refers to is the fact that the higher your level of immunization is, or your vaccination rate is amongst the population, the less likely that a virus such as measles is going to find a victim. So you think about this, you know, the measles virus kind of floating around, and it's looking, oh, he's vaccinated, she's vaccinated, she's vaccinated, he's vaccinated. They can't find anywhere to go. But if you have and measles is the most contagious infectious disease on the planet. The average person can infect 20 other people, which is really astronomical. And so you have to have the vaccination rate very high in the population. So we want the herd immunity to be, you know, 90 to 95% to protect against measles taking hold in the population. And what happens is, when you have your vaccination rates fall, you kind of reach a threshold where if the virus finds, you know, remember the virus is eliminated in the Americas largely, but it is not eliminated in places like Europe and Asia. And there are travelers. And what may happen is a traveler may come to Disneyland and come in contact with an unvaccinated Californian child, and now that virus finds a home in this person. That person then goes to school, and often one of the sad things about the anti-vaccine movements is that these individuals all cluster together, because they tend to share the same, you know, socio-political demographic views, and they all like to live in certain places like Marin County, for example, in California, and then this virus can then spread like wildfire through that population because the herd immunity isn't high enough, because there's so much clustering of unvaccinated persons. So if you're an unvaccinated person and you live in Mississippi, for example, which has one of the highest vaccination rates in the country, you're probably pretty safe, because that virus is never going to get to you, because it's going to keep running into vaccinated people all around you. Or if you're an immunosuppressed person, Mississippi or West Virginia might be good places to live, because they have high vaccination rates, and you know that population is not going to allow measles, for example, to take hold there.
I'm going to ask you to speculate for a second. So there is a strain, I think a pretty small one, but significant in the objectivist world, that I think shares the kind of anti-vaccine approach or concerns. How do you account for that? And given that the science is clear on this, and that this is people who are presumably very big on being scientific.
And this is only my own speculation, and it may not be completely valid. I think there probably is, you know, a bunch of people that really heed like a libertarian type of philosophy, where they think that, you know, that that the ideal is to live in a society, you know, close to anarchism, where there is no, where you kind of do what you want, and if you don't want to vaccinate your child, it doesn't necessarily matter. It's the government telling you to vaccinate your child. That's violating your liberty, not really ignoring the fact that the child has his own rights, that in the child, and you're putting the child at risk, and the fact that certain diseases can violate the rights of others if you spread them. That's the only explanation I can really think of, is that people really misunderstand what liberty means and think that liberty means that you can do, you know, you can refrain from vaccinating your children and think that that's an okay thing. And then I guess it takes a lot of evasion to ignore the science and to minimize the actual impact of these diseases. And they're always, you know, people in general try to look for loopholes when you have we had a measles death in the United States not long ago, which was kind of the first in several years. And there was, you know, a big search looking for kind of any kind of loophole for why this person died, because they don't want to sometimes acknowledge the fact that measles kills. They can brush it off when they say measles kills 150,000 people because most of those kids are in Africa and Asia, and they say they're not going to die in the United States. And while that might be true, measles can kill and did kill in the United States and will kill again if given the chance. So I think it's a mix of a misunderstanding of what liberty means, coupled with just basically ignoring certain facts about vaccine-preventable diseases.
Yeah, I suspect that's right. And I think towards your second point, there's also a sort of strain in among subjectivists that's anti-big business, or certainly anti-big pharma, in the GMO world. They are distrustful of any evidence that a company is putting out saying that that our products are safe and don't have all these side effects.
Yeah, I find that odd, you know, because you expect objectivists to be advocates of capitalism and really understanding what's in a business of self-interest, but it's in no business of self-interest to damage their customers with a vaccine that's going to cause problems. And the fact is, you know, Big Pharma doesn't really make that much money on vaccines. It was actually a money loser for Big Pharma because of lawsuits, because of the fact that, you know, they're bigger blockbuster drugs that they can get to market and make more money on. And we actually had shortages of influenza vaccine recently and tetanus shots recently because there was really a dearth of manufacturers and vaccines. People had really moved out of it. It's only when, you know, now we're starting to see, you know, a more robust vaccine industry, and that's probably on, you know, thanks to Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation, who has really started to think about global health initiatives that they can support. And now companies are trying to make more and newer innovative vaccines because there's a big pull from the global health community now and some of the donors. So really that wasn't ever an issue. Big Pharma had kind of relegated vaccines to very low on their portfolio. And the other thing is that they were actually, they're more cautious because of the anti-vaccine movement than they have to be, because they're so afraid of any minor side effect. And there are probably lots of vaccines that kind of get put on the shelf because the side effect profile is too high for people to tolerate. And even the FDA is very allergic to any kind of criticism from the anti-vaccine movement. It's really a vicious cycle that we're stuck in here.
So it sounds like you've confronted this viewpoint at least to some extent, where people, you know, they view it as an individual rights issue, and maybe they're wary of big business or big pharma. And I know you've talked a little bit about, like, okay, well, people can actually die from these diseases. They're really bad. They're horrible diseases. But do you find that convinces people, or what do you find actually works when you're trying to convince people of taking a different viewpoint?
So I have a couple different tacks. When I'm speaking, you know, to the public or to the press, there's one tact. When I'm speaking to an individual patient, I take a different tact. So when you're speaking to an individual patient or a mother or a father who's afraid of getting vaccinating their child, you really have to spell it out. And I've shown, you know, them pictures of children with measles. I've showed them statistics just literally on a computer to try and get them to sway the other way. And that sometimes works on an individual kind of retailing the vaccine basis. But what we found that's my own anecdotal experience, and just like I said, anecdotes don't really make a rule. When you look at major studies where they've tried to confront anti-vaccine people, giving them vaccine information, these anti-vaccine parents actually become more anti-vaccine. There was a major study in a pediatric journal showing that when they were given shown the data about the MMR and autism, they became much more staunchly, you know, they believe the opposite of what we wanted them to. So a lot of these people have fixed beliefs that are very, very hard to shatter. But one good thing that's happened is after this Disneyland outbreak and the way the press covered it and the way that the way that people got up in arms about the fact that measles was now finding a foothold in the United States again, got people to actually start thinking about this. And we've seen some decrement in the anti-vaccine movement and less credibility. They've lost some credibility with the general public. Some of these celebrities are openly ridiculed now, like Jenny McCarthy is all the time. So it's become, it was unfortunate that we had to have, you know, almost 200 cases of measles in 2015 to get people to actually realize what we've been telling them for so long. And I think that may be the only way that people can sometimes learn is to have some kind of reminder that we live in civilization and luxury, and we have the luxury of not fearing these infectious diseases that the rest of the world does fear, and that our grandparents feared. We're basically, a lot of these people have become victims of our own success. They're forgetting the root of why we don't have measles in the United States, or why we don't have polio in the United States. And I think they just don't have the luxury that they don't really appreciate where it came from the minds of those scientists and physicians who developed these vaccines and the pharmaceutical companies that funded them.
Well, I was just going to say, my view is that when you have a non-scientific movement posing as scientific, that you have to treat it as disreputable. And like, just as you wouldn't say, okay, let's have a public debate with creationists on whether or not their theory is true and let's look at the evidence pro and con, but you basically dismiss it and treat it as like really contemptible. I think when you have a clear-cut case like that, that's really what's important, not to change their minds, because as you suggest, they're not open to evidence. But to help the public, this is not an issue you should be torn on. You should look at it. But when you look at it, what you'll see is super clear cut.
Yeah, I think that's one way of getting the public to understand. The other thing is that, you know, public shaming goes a long way. So if you're going to a daycare center and you ask the daycare center, what's your vaccination policy at the daycare center? And then you say, and if it's not what you like, then I think that you kind of publicly shame us. You know, that daycare center doesn't require vaccinations, and there's this, you know, this percentage of kids are not vaccinated there. And the same thing you can do with schools. That data is available, and I think that that's one way to do it, is to start shunning kids. You know, I'm not, you know, you're, someone's going to a birthday, and it kind of sounds harsh, but you need to keep your children's safety in mind. And if you're going to a birthday party, and there are going to be a lot of unvaccinated children there, that's a little bit scary. I'm not a parent, but I think that would be a very scary proposition. Or, you know, you hear that someone down the road, down your street, is having a chickenpox party, which is absurd. That you basically publicly shun that person and say this is really
that's
dangerous. Chickenpox parties are a thing, and actually in England they're very common. But yeah, people will all bring all their children over when one has chickenpox, and they all play so they all can spread the disease around. It's actually horrible that you have. So during the measles outbreak, they were starting to have measles parties in California, and the California government had to tell people, do not have a measles party. I mean, that's really, you know, the fact that the government had to be that paternalistic is really more actually an indictment of the culture more than it is the government, that you had to tell people, do not expose your children to a potentially deadly infectious disease voluntarily.
Yeah, well, that's one thing that worries me about this exemption that you can get in a public school. So if you essentially have to send your children to public schools, and then they go there, and to add insult to injury, they're also going to be exposed to a number of unvaccinated children. That seems like that we're sponsoring a measles party in public schools as well.
Exactly. And, you know, school, you know, there's, you know, truancy laws, so parents are forced to, in the way that our, you know, our education system is set up, a lot of parents can't afford to do private schools or to go to, or to homeschool their children or use a private tutor. So they're basically forced to go to a public school, and then it's unsafe because there may be unvaccinated children there. And think about what they do with, like, you can't really bring peanut butter into a public school now, but you can bring measles into a public school.
All right, we're here with Hamish Adalja, and we're going to take a short commercial break.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem, these works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
When The Fountainhead was first published more than 70 years ago, Ayn Rand's bold literary vision and groundbreaking philosophy of individualism captured the world's attention. Initially rejected by 12 publishers as too intellectual, the novel became an instant classic and continues to provoke heated debates. What motivates a creative thinker? Is it a selfless desire to benefit mankind, a hunger for fame, fortune, and accolades, the need to prove superiority, or is it a self-sufficient drive to pursue a creative vision independent of others' needs or opinions? Ayn Rand addresses these questions through her portrayal of Howard Roark, an innovative architect who, as she puts, struggles for the integrity of his creative work against every form of social opposition. It's also the story of his love affair with a woman who seeks to defeat him. The Fountainhead is as relevant today as it was when Rand first penned it. The novel was also a personal landmark for Rand. In Howard Roark, she presented for the first time the uniquely Ayn Rand hero, man as he could be and ought to be. Order your copy today in Amazon.com.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
Okay, we're back. We're here with Amish Adalja talking about vaccines. So I want to ask you, Amish, I mean, obviously you're an expert with a lot of experience and scientific knowledge, but I'm interested in what sort of advice or tips you have for people without your specific knowledge, like how would they, what you would recommend for them in forming an opinion on maybe the latest health-related news that they see. So if they see a headline that says vaccines cause autism or there's a link between the two, or, for example, the recent World Health Organization announcement that red meat causes cancer, that's how at least the news portrayed it. So what kind of, like, how do you go through when you see a headline like that? What kinds of questions do you ask yourself? How do you form an opinion?
Well, the first thing I look at is, you know, does it make biological sense? Is there some, is it have some kind of face validity? You know, do I know enough about meat? Do I know enough about cancer? Do I know enough about vaccines? Do I know about whatever they're talking about? And if it's something completely absurd, like, you know, people who, you know, listen to Taylor Swift are more likely to get into car accidents. That doesn't make, you know, biological plausibility to me. That seems to be just a straight correlation. So first, you have to kind of unpack what they're saying and say, you know, do I know enough in my own general knowledge in being, you know, an average person to think about what do I know about this, what do I know about that. And there's some things that you could just throw out right on their face because of that. But often you might get into a situation where it is a little bit more difficult, and it is sometimes hard when you're reading general press accounts because they tend to simplify, they tend to sensationalize, and they tend to go with a punchline that doesn't necessarily always fit exactly with what the researcher or the research is actually saying. So I would say that, you know, making sure that you look at a more reputable source of a, you know, you often find these health websites that may, that if you're seeing this on a health website, it may not necessarily have the same type of rigor as, you know, looking at the New York Times health reporter writing about it, where they're actually delving into the science, or a Scientific American or a science, you know, a journalist that is really well versed at explaining things. And then what you have to do is basically, you're going to end up having to rely on experts, because, you know, if I read something about a new car, if I'm reading about some new system in a car, I can't really judge all of that myself. I can say, okay, that makes sense, but I don't know. I'm not an automotive engineer, so I don't know if it's actually true. So you're going to have to rely on experts. I think experts are essential in certain contexts, but you have that expert, hopefully, is somebody that doesn't just pontificate, but actually gives you reasons in your own context of why this is true, backs up their evidence, tells you what they know, tells you what they don't know, gives you other resources to look at, answers all the questions that you can pose. And then I think you can take that as a way forward. So I think it is going to be a lot of just, you know, some common sense and some searching on your own, plus finding experts in the field that you're inquiring about that have some credibility and act, you know, appropriately as experts. And, you know, I think there's a chapter in Alex Epstein's book on fossil fuels where he talks about the role of an expert in his field. And I think that's really instructive. And people, you know, maybe your listeners should read that section if they haven't, because it really talks about what an expert should and should do, and what you can expect from them and what you can't, and how to, you know, be a consumer of science. And also there's a philosopher named Greg Salmieri who's given a talk on how to be a consumer of objective science. And I think I recommend his talk as well, because it also goes into how a person can go step by step and evaluate claims that they may not have expertise in.
So are there certain experts, I mean, for health, you know, health related things, you know, Dr. Oz, for example, comes to mind as someone that people probably think is a respected source of information. How do you figure out who, you know, who is an expert and how to judge them?
I hope that most of the public can tell that Dr. Oz is a little different than most other physician experts. He's one thing when he's in his Columbia University role, but another on TV. But you really have to talk. It sometimes can be hard because there are a lot of people that you may not have the qualifications to. But there are, you know, general rules of thumb. I kind of illustrated them earlier. You know, is this person saying stuff that makes sense in your context? Is he relating to you in your context? Is he giving you sources? Is he answering all your questions adequately? Is he able to tell you what he knows and what he doesn't know, and where the limitations are, where science hasn't yet reached? And I think that's important. But of course, there's going to be, you know, some people that claim to be experts may not necessarily be objective experts, and there's always going to be that risk. And I think that people will really have to use their ability to judge a person's character as best as they can, and see how consistent they are over time, and look at their prior predictions and their prior advice, and see how it really dealt with the actual events. But it is a hard topic, I think there's a lot of work to be done to try to actually figure out what really makes an expert a good expert. And I hope sometimes when I'm on the press site that I fulfill that, because I do a lot of press, and I try to take, you know, keep this in mind when I'm speaking, that I'm not, that I'm actually, you know, fulfilling my role as an expert on infectious disease appropriately. But it is a challenging prospect for the general public, especially if there's differing opinions from two different experts, which happens sometimes.
All right. Thank you very much, Amish Adalja. So where can people follow your work?
You can follow me on Twitter. It's at Amish AA, so AMESHAA. I talk a lot about infectious disease issues there. I also have a blog called Tracking Zebra. You can find that at www.trackingzebra.com, where I have a little analysis of some of the news that may be going around in the general press about infectious disease topics that people might find interesting. It's written for the lay audience, so it's not too technical.
All right. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to take a commercial break, and we'll be back to wrap up in a moment.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence at a man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before. The first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism, and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten. Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
Every day we hear from political leaders that the American dream is vanishing because of rising income inequality. The rich are getting richer by rigging the system, leaving the rest of us to struggle to get by. To save the American dream, we're told that we need to fight inequality through tax hikes, wealth redistribution schemes, and a far higher minimum wage. But what if that narrative is wrong? What if the real threat to the American dream is not rising inequality, but forced equality? In their forthcoming book, Equal is Unfair: America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, Don Watkins and Yaron Brook reveal that almost everything we've been taught about inequality is wrong. You'll discover why successful CEOs make so much money and why they should, how the minimum wage hurts the very people it claims to help, why claims of middle-class stagnation are a myth, and more. For more information or to pre-order the book, Equal is Unfair, visit your favorite bookseller or go to Amazon.com.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem, these works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
Welcome back. We were speaking with Amish Adalja, an infectious disease expert, and he had a number of really interesting things to say in the interview, and some of them really have gotten me thinking. One thing that I thought was particularly interesting that he was talking about is what happens when you try to bring information to the anti-vaccine movement. So he talked about they were given pamphlets that explain, look, vaccines don't cause autism, and rather than that changing their mind, it actually caused them to dig in deeper and to reinforce the views that they had already held. So Don, what do you think that says about the anti-vaccine movement in general?
I think it's definitely one indication that you're not dealing with a scientific movement. And I think in any kind of issue, you want to try to figure out first of all, is this a scientific dispute, or is one side masquerading as science in order to justify something that's held not for scientific reasons? And that can often be hard, but one sort of indication you're going to look for is that do they change their views in light of evidence? And then if they do change their views, are they contrite about the damage they may have caused from being wrong? So if you have a celebrity out there saying, don't get vaccinated because this causes autism, and then it's definitively shown that, no, it doesn't cause autism. I mean, you think about how you would feel even if it was an honest mistake. You would feel horrible that you may have been responsible for convincing somebody to do something that had led to the harm or death of their child. And yet you see none of that from the anti-vax movement. And so contrast that with Amish's approach, which is it was so precise. It was so focused on giving you the positives and the negatives, the upsides and the risks, and trying to quantify those and pointing to where the real evidence lies. And that's just kind of a first level entry into how to think about these issues, is that you want to find experts who are really specific, who are not just giving you a distorted, one-sided case, and who are willing to answer questions as you say, well, what's your evidence for that? How do you back that up? Are those reliable studies and so on? And I think you see that from the pro-vaccine side way, way more, to say it the least, than from the anti-vax side.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. So if you think about what kinds of things come out of the anti-vaccine movement, I mean, a lot of it are these little Facebook memes that make, you know, some definitive statement like, you know, vaccines contain mercury, stop pumping your children full of toxins. And I mean, that's a huge, huge, I mean, obviously a huge contrast to the way that Amish would talk about the issue. And he's really was giving you his considered opinion versus, you know, trying to tell you some sort of a buzzword or get you to, you know, to react emotionally to, you know, at least exclusively emotionally to what he was saying. And I think that's also you know, very indicative of what type of, you know, what type of movement and what type of, you know, people were you're dealing with when it comes to the anti-vaccine movement. Another thing that Amish said that I thought was really interesting is this issue of thimerosal or mercury in vaccines. He said something I've never heard anybody say before, is that he said he wished that there was more mercury in vaccines. And that's interesting because he said that, look, this is a preservative and it prevents germs and bacteria and fungus from growing inside of the vaccine. And that's really, really important for, you know, if you want a safe product that doesn't actually cause harm. And considering that this preservative hasn't caused harm to people, there's no link, as some people say, to autism, et cetera. It's disturbing to me that this anti-science movement has been successful in having thimerosal removed from vaccines. And so I think it raises a question about how can we better help companies stand up for themselves and to, you know, to come down on the side of science. So what do you think about that?
I mean, it's certainly disheartening when you see companies, and I mean, this happens. You talk about GMOs a lot. You'll see it happen in companies. Oh, we're taking the GMOs out of our food and so on, or our company's going green. You see a lot of this caving into irrational public pressure. And I think in some cases the companies are culpable and they should stand up more. But I think the primary responsibility in these cases is fundamentally with our intellectual leaders, both the people, say, spearheading the anti-vaccine movement who are concocting all of these irrational claims and really pushing them, but even more widely in the fact that we're not really taught how to think about scientific issues. The fact is that you should have learned in high school and in college how to process things so that you can ask a question like, is the mercury that is bad the same as the mercury is good? And I think that the educational establishment and our intellectuals have failed us. And it's worse than a failure because they've actually done the opposite, which is think about in the global warming or climate change debate, how we're taught to think about things. We're not told the evidence for it. We're told 97% of scientists disagree, and so you should just obey them as authorities. And if your whole mindset is geared towards, well, what do the authorities tell me, and how are you even to pick which authorities to believe? And so it's this real lack of scientific education on the part of the public that I think is the real thing that we should go after. And to make matters worse, so Amish mentioned that there's a lot of science to back up the pro-vaccine argument, but that it's done or at least funded primarily by the vaccine creators. And I mean, that's by necessity because they have a vested interest in it and therefore they're going to put their money behind it. But we're also taught to have suspicion about anybody who is associated with industry, because after all, if they're profit seeking, don't they want to just line their pockets regardless of the actual consequences for people? Never mind that you can't really line your pockets if you're actually killing people and all your customers are dying off.
It tends to be bad for business.
Yeah, it tends to be bad too. And so what you get is this kind of it puts the companies in an impossible situation. People don't understand science, and the science that they produced is dismissed. And so I think that's the number one thing that we should be concerned with, is having building a more scientifically literate culture, and one that does not write off and smear as non-objective industry and business, whereas supposedly the only objective people are those who get their money from government or from some ideologically driven nonprofit.
Yeah, just because a company does have a stake. They have skin in the game. They want, at least a proper one should want their products to be safe. And that's part of what it's their job to do, is to make sure that the products they're making and marketing, are safe and actually good and do the things that they say they are. But one of the things you said about, this issue of people are taught to trust authority, I mean, that's interesting. So what does it look like when you're talking to, what does it look like for a person to really be an expert? I mean, I've never heard, for example, we didn't hear Amish, for example, say, I'm a doctor, so you should listen to me. So what does it look like when you're really dealing with an expert?
The issue with expertise is that they know way more than they could possibly explain to you. Yet what they try to do is they'll answer as far as they can take you and as far as you're interested in. And I mean, a real good sign of expertise actually is the ability to present an issue very simply in terms that you can understand, but then the willingness to answer questions that break that down, that back that up, that explain kind of more important distinctions and so on. And I think we saw that in the interview, is that, we started out talking about just a common sense, big picture view of, look, millions of people used to die from diseases that now they don't die for. And then it was able to break it down to, well, aren't there certain risks? And he was able to specify that, the kinds of risks that you actually see. So that is the picture of what it looks like to get a sense of, all right, I'm dealing with an expert, and how an expert should deal with you. That is, they'll present the evidence that is objective to you and willingly answer questions, and then point you in the direction of even more thorough resources if you're interested in. And Amish mentioned, and I highly encourage this, I don't know if it's available online yet, but Gregory Salmeri gave a in-depth lecture on exactly this issue. How should we as consumers of science be objective consumers of science and of expertise? And I think it really lays out this issue nicely. So I guess if it's not up now, just keep checking YouTube every single day.
Yeah, because that was definitely I was able to attend that lecture live, and it was a lot to think about and a lot of really good stuff about how do you judge what someone's telling you? Can you, if somebody says something at a party kind of off the cuff, to make sure that you're really thinking through, rather than just adding it as a data point into your brain and then, making decisions on that, to really be careful about what you're letting into your mind as that's going to stand as evidence, to be thoughtful and careful. And I think Amish also gave some really good advice about, how he thinks through, a news story or an issue that comes up, that he's going to go and seek out more information to ask himself questions and big picture questions like, does it even seem reasonable? Does it fit within the rest of my framework of things that I know to be true? But here's a question. So say you don't have time, or you're not really interested in doing that for any particular, news story or claim that comes up. So then what do you do? How do you treat that?
I mean, life is really short. So, we keep stressing how much work goes into gaining knowledge, and that's important, but that also means you have to be selective about what you pursue as knowledge. And so there's nothing wrong with, if you don't have children, there's nothing wrong with saying, look, I've not looked into the vaccination debate. I might have certain hypotheses about what's true or not, but none of that is knowledge. And so I won't treat it as knowledge. Greg, I think, often puts it as citation required or whatever, what they have on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And it's, okay, I've heard this. It sounds kind of interesting. One day I might look into that, but it doesn't have the status of knowledge at all. It's just an issue to be looked into. And that's fine. Most of the stuff in our mind is going to have that status. And the real key thing is just to be self-critical and introspective about the different status that things have in our mind. And then if we do need to act on something, or if it is important in our thinking, then to pursue it objectively and rigorously. But to not take that lightly, and not think that you can just very quickly talking to kind of one resource or one Facebook post or even, one op-ed in a newspaper that seems friendly to our ideological proclivities, think that we really have a view, that it actually takes significantly more work than that. So to have a view on vaccines, I think it doesn't take weeks and weeks of effort, but it is going to take at least hours and hours of effort.
Yeah, this reminds me of something actually my father-in-law said. He was an engineer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, so he worked for NASA for a good portion of his life. And we were sitting around the family, and there was kind of shooting the breeze, and someone asked something, and then, of course, what usually happens is people jump in with their speculations and, trying to figure out, well, what could be the cause of this? And he just said simply, I don't think there's any value in speculation. And I think that's a really interesting point of view that, like a lot of times what happens is people, you speculate what could be happening here. And instead of treating that really as speculation, it can stand in your mind as real information and actual data. And just to be really vigilant and careful that that's not what you're doing. When you're talking, when you really are just speculating. Okay, so I think we're going to take a little commercial break and we'll be right back.
Selfishness, a virtue? It is according to the moral principles of objectivism. Conventional morality tells you to sacrifice your values to satisfy the needs of others. Ayn Rand opposes that view and offers a new concept of egoism, an ethics of rational selfishness that rejects sacrifice in all its forms. In The Virtue of Selfishness, Ayn Rand defies conventional thought, setting out a philosophy that holds man as a heroic being, with his own happiness as the moral purpose of his life. Explore Rand's new concept of egoism and order The Virtue of Selfishness at Amazon.com today.
You didn't build that. You don't pay your fair share. Who do you think you are? Ayn Rand knew exactly who you are. Rational, productive, independent. You work hard and use your own judgment. You choose your career path, your lifestyle, your values. You're living the American dream. And now you see that there are people who want to take away what you've created and who will call their lust to loot a virtue. People who think the needs of others is a claim on your money, your work, your life. Well, how can you fight back? That's what they do at the Ayn Rand Institute. They look closely at public policy beyond sound bites and election cycles, at the fundamental moral ideas that frame crucial debates. They focus on reframing the issues in line with reason, egoism, and individual rights to life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness. Your life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of your happiness. Stand up with them to fight against the sacrifice of your values by making a contribution today at AynRand.org/support. They'll use your money to defend your values.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at AynRand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
Ayn Rand was a radical thinker whose philosophical novels challenged students to reconsider their views on fundamental issues. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, and Anthem. These works have become classics of American literature that never fail to engage young people and stimulate intense classroom discussion. By offering these works for free to teachers, the Ayn Rand Institute hopes to encourage greater awareness and understanding of Rand's stimulating perspective. If you're a teacher who would like Ayn Rand's books in your classroom, visit AynRand.org. This is at no cost to you. Go to AynRand.org today.
For 30 years, the Ayn Rand Institute has been on the front lines of the culture wars, introducing millions of students to Ayn Rand's books and ideas, educating young intellectuals who now teach at universities around the world, and speaking out in defense of free speech, free markets, and free minds. You can join our battle for reason, individualism, and capitalism by making your contribution today at AynRand.org/support.
And we're back. This is Amanda Maxim. I'm here with Don Watkins. We're filling in on the Yaron Brooks Show. And as we're reaching the end of our time together, we just like on the Yaron Brooks Show, we like to end on a positive note to highlight some good that's happening maybe out in the culture or in our personal lives. So for this portion of the show, I'd like to give you something positive that's a little bit more personal. And in fact, it's a little bit of a trivia fact as well. That not a lot of people know. But as it turns out, Amish and I, when we were kids, we didn't know each other. We grew up in different parts of the country, but we had the same favorite book as children. And that book centered around...
Was it Atlas Shrugged?
Well, yeah, not when I was five, unfortunately. I don't know how much I would have gotten out of it. Yeah, this is geared more for children, but the book does similar to Atlas Shrugged. It centers around a science hero, and so I wanted to tell you a little bit about the book and about the hero involved. So the book is titled the Value of Believing in Yourself: The Story of Louis Pasteur, and So who is Louis Pasteur? You probably know from his name from pasteurization, which is so basically he's the scientist that invented. He did a lot of work on bacteriology and chemistry. He invented the rabies vaccine, and he also invented a process for pasteurization. So that's the way how we can sterilize milk by heating it in order to ensure that less bacteria grows in the milk. And both of these things were just utterly transformative in terms of people's lives. The rabies vaccine, and just in fact, his whole theory of that, he confidently stood up in the story. It's about Louis Pasteur believing in himself. So he's got the evidence that that bacteria and germs are what causes disease, even though maybe other people in the medical community think that that's not true. But he goes about trying to find to confirm that theory, and then also finds a cure and eventually a vaccine for rabies. And then he goes on with that knowledge to invent the process of pasteurization, which a lot of people, especially children, used to die from drinking milk that was contaminated with bacteria. So I thought it was interesting that we both happen to have the same favorite book as children, and that book also focused on a historical figure, a science hero. So, Don, what was your – tell me about your favorite children's book.
I don't remember what my favorite book was as a kid, but that does remind me of – so I have a daughter, and one of her many names is Calpurnia. It's her second middle name, and we actually got that – because I guess a few months or a year before we had her, We read a book that actually came out relatively recently called The Evolution of Calpurnia Tate. And it's a girl growing up in the Ozarks, I believe, at the turn of the century. And, you know, Darwin has just come out, and her grandfather is a naturalist, and he's always been kind of standoffish and, you know, a shadowy figure in the background. But she becomes very fascinated by naturalism. And the story is really just about her passion for getting better and better at this skill, deciding that this is what she wants to do with her life. She wants to be a naturalist like her grandfather and like Darwin. And as you get to the end of the book, I won't spoil everything, but she encounters the fact that women aren't supposed to do that. Women are supposed to stay in the home and become mothers. And, you know, she's on the cusp of womanhood at this point. And you wonder what's going to happen. What kind of choice does she make? What kind of future will she have? But it's so rare. It's very hard to find great female heroic characters like that, great science books like that, and then female characters who actually have usable names. So, you know, we weren't going to go with Antigone, so Calpurnia was.
That's great. So I'm interested to know who your science hero is, or what your favorite book was as a kid. So if you jump on Twitter, you can tweet at me. I'm at Dr. Maxim. That's M-A-X-H-A-M, D-R-M-A-X-H-A-M. Go ahead and tweet at me. Who is your science hero as a kid? What was your favorite book? And I'd be interested to know. So Don, what are you up to for the rest of the week?
Well, we're recording this earlier, so by the time everybody's listening to it, I'll actually be in Atlanta, Georgia, for what's called the Strive Conference. And Strive is an organization for objectivist students, and the conference is on the morality of value creation and trade. And there'll be a lot of great speakers there. Yaron Brook will be there from the Institute, Ankar Gadte, Steve Simpson, I believe a few others, and then Amish will be there speaking as well. And a lot of different topics. I'll actually be speaking on the way in which the critics of inequality vilify ambition. And so I usually talk about inequality from a more policy perspective. What are the implications of this for the kinds of activities that the government will and proposals that the government will implement? And this is really an opportunity to look at what happens when people what are the effect of the ideas that the inequality alarmists push on individuals? And I think it'll be a really good opportunity to look at it from a different perspective. And then I'm looking forward to hearing the talks from everybody else. And the week after that, I'm going to Chicago for what's called the Freedom Summit, and Ankar Gadte will be there as well. And I'll be talking again this time on turning the tables on the inequality alarmists. All of this is which is a precursor to my book with Yaron Brook, Equal is Unfair, how income inequality is – what is the last part of the book?
You wrote it.
Yeah, I'm blanking out right now, which is ridiculous.
America's
misguided fight against income inequality. So I'll be speaking on that, and a bunch of really conservative, you know, well-known figures like Ann Coulter and Sean Hannity will be there, and some of the presidential candidates. So hopefully we'll have a good turnout, and hey, maybe we can, you know, get some of the candidates to read the book.
Yeah, that would be huge. So the Strive Conference is for who's going to be there? It's for students.
It's for student anybody who is a, you know, fan of Ayn Rand in one way or another. I think can be invited. You've already missed it if you're hearing this now. But I think they'll definitely be doing more stuff in the future. And so I encourage anybody who's interested in all of these events and the other talks and events we're doing to visit AynRand.org, where they can find all of that information.
All right, great. That's all we have time for. So this is Amanda Maxim for Don Watkins saying, you know, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.